Let's return to our text. So the woman says to Jesus, they have no wine, and this is his response. We need to take it carefully. First part of the response, woman, not mother, not Mary, not cuddles, or whatever Jesus called his mother. I don't know what your kids call you, mothers. Whatever little familiar name she might have had, he might have had for her. Woman, and by the way, this woman only ever appears in the gospel in one other scene, and that's at the foot of the cross. And once again, Jesus addresses her as woman. She's here as woman. She's the new Eve. She's the mother of the living. She's every woman, every mother, every life giver. So he addresses her, woman, and the first response is, I won't say a rejection, but it's a holding at arm's length. It's a challenge. It's a, what concern is that to you and to me? It's a question. Now that phrase occurs, as I've noted in your notes with references, it occurs a number of times in the Bible, and you can look them up later. Sometimes it's actually a rejection. It's a way of saying, no, this is none of our business, keep out of it. That's what it sounds like a bit. Sometimes it's not a rejection, but it's always a challenge. It's always saying, do you know what you're doing? Have you thought about this? Do you realize what you're asking? Do you see this the way I see it? Are you sure we're looking at this from the same point of view? It's that kind of balk. Whether Jesus is simply challenging his mother or whether he's rejecting her request can only be found from the context. And we'll see in a moment, he certainly doesn't reject her request. So there's no way of interpreting this as a rejection. It doesn't fit. But it is a challenge to her, to us. It's saying, okay, maybe I used to mow the lawns, Mary, for you when you asked me at home and I did what I was told. Unless you leave mother and father for my sake, you are not worthy of me. If Jesus is going to respond to this woman, it's not going to be because she's his mother. We're not dealing with family ties here or family obligations. Jesus can only act now from the will of God. If it's God's will for him to act, he will, and both he and she have to wait on God. We're adult to adult here, and we're in a relationship which is far more sacred and important than the beautiful natural relationship with its necessary commitments of mother and son. So we're not into mother-son here. We're into woman and Jesus. So there's that initial, and we'll see that Mary picks the challenge up beautifully in the next line. Then he says something, and you're going to kill me for this, because it's rather difficult. He says, and there's the translation, my hour has not come yet. Now that phrase, excuse me, that phrase occurs, what was it, 8 times, I haven't counted them, 8, 9, 7, 10 times in the Gospel of John, and that's the way it's translated. I've got the text references for you if you want to look them up later. Sometimes the people try and capture Jesus and it says they couldn't do it because his hour had not yet come. Sometimes Jesus will say in other circumstances, my hour has not yet come. In fact, then finally in chapter 12 he says, my hour has come. And the hour is the hour of the crucifixion, of the life-giving on the cross. That's the hour of glory. That's the moment we're leading up to. And at that hour, Jesus will say, it is finished, it is perfected. I've achieved my goal, like he says in Luke, in that other text. On the third day, I will achieve my end. So it's true that the hour has not yet come to its completion. It's not at all surprising that in this text, these scholars, and they are good scholars, translate this text in exactly the same way. However, the Greek manuscripts on which we're drawing were done in capital letters, They were done without any punctuation, and they were done without any spacing in between words. Now, if you tried that in English and did everything in capital letters equally spelt, for the most part, we could work out where one word ends and where another word begins, because it's going to be pretty rare that you could fit the beginning of one word onto the end of another and kind of make different sense of it. But I'm sure it could happen, I just haven't taken the time to think of an example to give you. So normally you can work it out, and so can you in Greek. But there's no punctuation either. The punctuation that the Greeks use for a question is a what we call a semicolon, a dot with a full stop, a full stop with a comma under it. That's the question. This could be a question. In fact, my opinion is, that's why I've gone to the trouble, is I think it is a question. I think it's better translated as a question. Jesus is asking questions here. Not that he wants Mary to answer them. He's asking her to answer them for herself. What concern is that to you and me? Has not my hour now come? Don't you realize that the moment has come not to complete but to begin the hour? This is the beginning. And he'll say in a moment, this is the first of the signs, and they saw his glory and they believed in him. This is the beginning of the public life of Jesus. The Spirit will begin to flow. The wine will begin to be poured out. Don't you realize, Mother, we're at a wedding banquet. Don't you know that my hour has come? Why are you so anxious? Why are you asking? Don't you realize God is going to pour out the most beautiful wine, the best wine is about to be poured. At any rate, that's what happens. So I want to retranslate that for you and say, and by the way, there's a long tradition of translating it this way, though it's not favoured by the scholars, and I don't know why. A lot of the scholars I have found in my reading, they are scholars of language, but not, well, some of them must be, but I rarely find a scholar who's also a poet or a dramatist, and I think that's the problem. I think you only see what you're trained to see, and I think if a Shakespeare was reading this, he'd see a lot in it that I can't see. And if a poet was reading it, he'd see a lot in it. If a woman was reading it, she'd see a lot in it. We can only kind of answer the questions we ask, and scholars are scholars, but they don't always ask, in my view, the obvious questions. I'm daring to think in this case I've asked it. At any rate, I'd like to answer it by saying this is a question. So what he's doing is saying, woman, woman, don't be anxious. God is about to act. This is the beginning of the time for which you've been longing. That's certainly how Mary takes it, because the next verse is, his mother says to the servants, do whatever he tells you. She doesn't take it as a rebuff. She knows something is about to happen on the third day. She senses from Jesus' questions that this is the moment of grace. So what does she do? As the perfect disciple, she's the first in John's Gospel to do it. The beloved disciple hasn't been introduced yet. She is the one, as in Luke's Gospel, to first respond to Jesus at the deepest level of faith. Luke has it in the lovely scene we call the Annunciation. Let it be done unto me according to your word. John has this woman who will also be standing by the cross, recognizing what everyone in the Old Testament recognizes, that the response to God is one of obedience, listening, ready to do God's will, the most basic human requirement of any disciple. So she accepts the challenge, lives up to it, and then tells everyone else to obey him. Now, in case you haven't had enough, the drama begins now. Now, standing there in this place were six stone water jars. Stone, I'll take out of your breasts a heart of stone and I will give you a heart of flesh. They're water jars, six of them. And as you look at the stage and see six, you who know that seven is the perfect number, You know that here you've got dramatized what? And it even tells us, for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. These symbolize the Jewish rituals of purification. Imperfect purification. The only thing that can purify our hearts, finally, is the Spirit of God poured into them. The only way you can purify something dark is to pour the light in. But they have their rituals, and they're not bad, they're just ineffectual. They can remind us that we need cleansing. But water up to the knees and up to the elbows won't do much for my soul or yours. So they're there for purification, they're there as reminders, and there are six of them, which means there are not seven. They're the fullness of imperfection. They're the complete, you can't get any more there without being into number seven, into the perfection of the promises. So the Old Testament has come to its completion, it's come to its end, it's done all it can. It's achieved its goal. It's prepared us for the word of Jesus. Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water." Again, a beautiful level after level of meaning in this, and I hope it's coming across to you. They fill them to the brim. That's all we can do. They're water jars. They're meant to hold water. The most we human beings can do is fill them to the brim with water. It won't help the wedding. They're looking for wine, not water. But where God doesn't create wine out of nothing. He doesn't go, and there's a whole pile of wine there. We have to bring all we've got. We have to present our bread and our wine on the altar. We have to bring our hearts, broken, ordinary human hearts. We have to do our bit. We have to labour by the sweat of our brow. We have to educate our children with the best wisdom we've got. It doesn't all fall from heaven. None of it falls from heaven. But what we do can be graced, transformed into. So we have to do it. We have to fill our lives with all we've got by way of love or patience or generosity or good works or whatever. But then we have to wait on the word. He said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the chief steward." So they took it. And when the steward tasted the water, that had become wine and didn't know where it came from, though the servants who drew the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom, cries out to God and says, "Everyone serves the good wine first and then the inferior wine. You've kept the good wine till now." And we think of Proverbs, "Come and eat my bread and drink the wine that I've mixed." This is the wine. This is the blood of the grape. This is the blood of the paschal lamb, this wine. This is Jesus' life given for the life of the world. This is the vine's sap and where the branches. This is the blood of Jesus which cleanses us, purifies us from sin. All of that's here in this scene. We don't grasp it all, but we grasp the symbol. And when you grasp a symbol, you grasp multivalent images. And they're all here, the vine and branches and so on. This is a Eucharistic scene. This is a Eucharistic breakfast. This is the resurrection. This is the pierced heart of Jesus on the cross with the blood and water flowing out. It's kind of all here, but it'll take the music of the whole drama to bring it all to us. And we're only in chapter 2. Jesus did this in the first sign of in Galilee and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. As I said to you at the beginning, and I'm now ready to conclude this first lecture, whatever happened at Cana or wherever, I don't know. You don't know. We haven't got the evidence. But we've got this wonderful portrait that's telling us about Jesus. And yet, in a way, Let's assume it happened the way it's described. There's nothing to say it didn't happen that way. Augustine has a rather lovely statement about it, which I'd like to read to you. Before I do, I need to quickly make a distinction. Fundamentalism, which I talked about in an introductory lecture, has no place today, and we know too much. I mean, we've got information that shows fundamentalism to be intellectually incoherent and intellectually dishonest. So teachers who learn anything can't do it honestly, because it simply ignores literature and ignores too many things that we know. But fundamentalism is a modern, insecure reaction against the mystery of the scriptures. It's quite a modern thing. Fundamentalism didn't exist in the ancient world, as I tried to show you in the first lecture, and it didn't exist in the medieval world. At the same time, they were more likely to take things in a literalist sense than we are. But even that's not true to say. Because, see, when you take a thing in a literalist sense, it depends on what you've done. If I think that the Earth is the centre of the cosmos today, after Copernicus and Galileo and a lot of science, that's different from thinking the Earth is in the centre of the universe back in 1100. It's a different mental place we're in. One ignores reality and rushes back to a preconception that can't be sustained. The other is an imaginative way of looking in the world which doesn't ask the questions and just assumes things are as you see them. You see the difference, I'm sure. So in the medieval world, they thought imaginatively, they thought symbolically. So the symbol and the reality are all perhaps like a child, maybe that's it. Prior to the discrete differences that education has brought us to, for a child, where does reality end and mystery begin? And anyhow, isn't reality mysterious anyhow? Isn't the whole thing rather miraculous? And where are the angels and where aren't the angels? Maybe they're closer to the whole reality than we blooming adults are. But at least they're unthinking world. So in that world, and here I want to read to you from Augustine, who, it would seem, assumed that Cana happened as it's described, and good on him. But listen to what he says. The miracle of our Lord Jesus Christ, by which he made wine from water, is certainly no wonder for those who know that God did it. For he, the very one who every year does this on vines, made wine on that day at the wedding in those 6 water jars which he ordered to be filled with water. For just as what the attendants put into the water jars was turned into wine by the Lord's action, so also when the clouds pour down, what the clouds pour down is turned into wine by the action of the same Lord. That doesn't amaze us because it happens every year. But by its regularity, it has lost its wonderment. Yet it merits even greater reflection than that which was done in the jars of water. And what Augustine is reminding us of is every glass of wine is a miracle, every flower is a miracle, every sunrise is a miracle, rain and life and children and love and death and the whole life is one big enormous miracle, because as we read in that poem by Hopkins, it was by Teilhard de Chardin, the whole of the world is charged with the mystery of God. It's all through it. So in a sense, everything is a miracle. Everything is a sign of God's action. And so, one shouldn't be surprised at this. But it isn't the point of the story. If a lucky couple happened to have plenty of wine at a wedding feast a long time ago, that's not going to do anything for my faith or your faith. And if you expect it to happen at your wedding, well, let me know if it does, but I think you'd probably have to go and buy some wine. Because what this scene is about the miracle of the Spirit of God flowing from the heart of Jesus as the mother cries out to God in her distress. And what we're watching is the transformation of the world, of the hearts of people, of religion by Jesus.